Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Once again to the Socialist Insight. Today we are covering a very interesting topic when we look at look at the political landscape here in the United States. And our program today is called The People versus the Corporations. And what we're going to be doing is talking with Alex Cigneri. He's supposed to be joining us. Ruth Ann, is Alex with us yet?
No, AJ is still not here. No.
Okay, AJ. I'm going to cover a few other things I wanted to talk about during the program. And one of the things in particular, we were looking at some of the events that have taken place over the last few years in regards to elections and campaign spending. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk a little bit about my election when I ran for governor in 2010, so there's still much to talk about. I believe when I was running for governor, was that the first time that I came in contact with you, Ruth Ann?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that long ago.
I was running as a candidate with the Socialist Party USA. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So that was in 2012. I believe 2011 was when our program began. Is that correct? The Socialist Insight?
No.
Okay.
I think this is 2015. It started,
August will be 2 years. August will
right,
be two,
right.
2 years that the program has been on.
Yeah, 2 years. Okay. Yeah, how about that? Uh-huh.
Okay, well, some of the things that happened in 2010, because I was reflecting on this program, and monies that are being spent on campaigns, whether they're state or federal campaigns. And back in 2010, I was running as a candidate for California governor with the Peace and Freedom Party. And at the same time, I was also a member of the Socialist Party USA. And during that election, there were several candidates and also big money spenders. Now, when you look at campaigns, basically, whether it's on a state or national level, campaigns, the success of the campaign is really predicated on the amount of money one spends or an organization spends on that campaign. When I was running for the office of California governor, you had Meg Whitman. She was running with the Republican Party. She's a wealthy billionaire that was running in opposition to Brown. And Meg Whitman spent $144 million, of her own funds to secure that office.
Oh.
Basically, I put out some information that Meg Whitman running for that office, it was Wall Street that was running a campaign. And many of us know Meg Whitman when she was the CEO for eBay.
Stuart,
in total for that campaign.
AJ?
Yeah.
Is that AJ?
Okay.
Oh, hi, AJ. How you doing?
Hey, guys.
I just wanted to mention, finish this up. In regards to that campaign in 2010, Meg Whitman spent $144 million. The total amount that was spent on that state campaign was $178.5 million. So you can see that campaigns in this country are driven by money. That was the most expensive political campaign in the history of California. We can see also when we look at some of the other campaigns that have taken place recently, we have the campaign that took place between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama in 2011 and 2012. During that campaign, you had Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, the two candidates. They spent $2 billion on just those two campaigns. Political committees accounted for $2.1 billion in spending, and campaigns spent by other monies that were spent by other campaigns during 2012 for on the federal level was $3.2 billion. That was $7 billion that was spent on campaigns. So you can see that there's big money in politics, U.S. politics, and that's what we're talking about today, the people versus the corporations. And Alex, thanks again for joining the program.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me back on.
Alex, you had invited me to come on your program when I was running
yes.
as a candidate, and I greatly appreciate it. Were there other candidates, third-party candidates that came on your program during the 2012 presidential election?
Not the 2012, recently.
After the election.
It was after the election. So I didn't have anyone else who ran in 2012 to come on the program. But in this year's election, I talked to Ted Grimm, who's a Libertarian candidate running for governor here in Illinois. And soon I'll be having Scott Summers, who will be running as the Green Party candidate in the governor's race as well. And then I also talked to Tito Hardeman, who is running against Pat Quinn on the Democratic Party ticket, but I talked to him because he was more of an outsider of the Democratic Party and wanted to know more why running those kinds of tickets. And, you know, to your point, Stuart, you know, as yourself and myself and others always have this question about why we have Citizens United, why are there big dollar signs when you're running for campaigns, you know? I mean, there's some, you know, serious costs like travel, paying staff, promotional stuff. So all that stuff makes sense. But when you have people who profit from elections, and by that I mean you have like lobby firms, you have consulting firms, you have all these people who just do nothing but that, and they cost like premium dollar in order to have those candidates. And I guess, you know, why do we even need to have that? I mean, why can't we just have just equal ballot access across the board and, you know, just, you know, listen to people and everything else?
Well, some of the things I see, Alex, is that, as I mentioned, there's big money in politics, U.S. politics. We look at the Political Action Committee, which is AIPAC, and that's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And here they spend countless millions of dollars to support their candidates. And these candidates, essentially, once they are elected into office by the monies that these big corporations and these big committees, PACs, put up, they are beholden to those organizations. Now, here you had Obama, when he was running for office in 2007 and 2008, he was presenting himself as the peace candidate, someone
right.
that was going to pursue peace around the world. And, of course, once he got into office, and also with the help and assistance and monies from AIPAC, he had mentioned a statement, "I will not hesitate to use force when it is necessary to defend the United States and its interests." And he was referring to this was his speech to AIPAC, saying that he would use force against Iran because of the potential threat in the region. We can understand that AIPAC, their interest was protecting Israel. But the thing is, this is making promises from the American people, with American funds that we're going to go into a potential armed conflicts because the president has made promises to this organization based on the funding that he has gotten from his campaign. But we understand that AIPAC, not just the president, but almost every member in Congress receives some type of support from AIPAC.
Right,
and
right.
When you look at the numbers of lobbyists in Washington, D.C., Alex, we have 40,000 lobbyists, 40,000 lobbyists in Washington. I mean, those numbers are mind-boggling. But
it is.
How would what is your opinion on that? Organizations that are able to spend these kind of monies and turn the people that you supposedly, and we'll get into this later, that we supposedly elect into office, but they become beholden to the people that buy their way into office. What are your comments on that?
Well, I mean, that's what the question I kind of posed a little earlier is like, you know, why do we even have these kind of top dollar kind of campaigns? As you said, you have PACs and super PACs, these 527s out there, like the PAC for Israel, Victory Fund, which is on the Democratic side, who provides funding for Democrat candidates who are LGBT or have an LGBT platform. And I guess, you know, why do – my view has always been money doesn't have to talk at all.
Uh-huh.
Money on a campaign is solely, in my view, to get you through that election. And if you are really – believe in your
now, what
political
do you mean when
part.
You say, what do you mean when you say get you through that election? What is that? What
well,
are you
like, well,
you're, to?
Well, whether it be a presidential race, a governor's race, state rep, state senate, U.S. Senate, that's the kind of that's getting through that election. And by that,
well, I mean
get
$2 billion,
PR.
as I mentioned, $2 billion between two candidates, that'll help to get you through an election. But that's
right.
A little excessive.
It is, but I guess when you're running a race like a president, you know, there's a lot of things at stake, and by that I mean the travel, the PR, things like that. So unfortunately, there is money to invest in to do that. Now, do you take tech money and do all the other kind of shenanigans that are happening, like Citizens United? No. You know, if you have people who actually support you and contribute those funds, whether it be in the million or billions, in order for you to win that race, or at least if you're going through the Electoral College, you know, getting to the seven states that really matter in order to win that election, then that's what it takes, you know. And unfortunately, because of the way campaigns are now with the strategy involved, it is a dog-eat-dog world, and, you know, you have to – I guess you kind of have to run that same game a little bit until someone can come up with a strategy.
Well, shouldn't there be some rules to any game?
There is. No, there should be some
because
rules.
Because
you know?
The rules – Alex, the rules are breaking down. They're breaking down right there in Congress. They're breaking down right there in the Supreme Court. I mean, so, you know, you say – rules. I'm trying to figure out what rules do we have today.
Well, we and that's the unfortunate part. We have no rules, and we need
right
rules to have people to have equal time in debates for presidency instead of having a commission that only says only a Democrat and Republican, and these criteria has to be involved. We need the rules saying, you know, this is how much money you can have in your respective race and everything, from your political party, from organizations, stuff like that, those kinds of rules need to be set in place and not have rules that are only for the two major parties. Because,
you know, Alex, you know, again, when I talk about rules, I've run several campaigns in 2006, I ran as a candidate for California Lieutenant Governor. I ran for governor. I was a vice presidential candidate. So I knew about that in 2008. In that election in 2012, I ran as a presidential campaign. But when you talk about rules, and you mentioned Citizens United. And Citizens United, that was based on the First Amendment, you know, the freedom of speech,
right,
where people and organizations, where they can be able to get their message out in regards to not barring or, prohibiting any limitations on that legislation. But here, Citizens United opened up the doorway, and we'll talk about Citizens United in a little bit, but it opened up the door where it opened the floodgates where monies could come in for these these organizations, where they could support the candidates, not directly, but indirectly. And when you look at under these restrictions, you know, it also opens up provisions where nonprofit organizations can be able to help those campaigns. Now, I'm thinking about, I wasn't asking for money or funds, but many times I had organizations were afraid to, within the last 3-4 years, to even invite me to come in to speak because they had a nonprofit status. They didn't want me to come to speak. I'm not even asking for money. But here you have the rules are being bent and broken, and big corporations are supporting their candidates based on what the federal courts are how they're making provisions for the two big parties. So that's what I'm talking about. When we talk about rules, the rules when it comes to the smaller candidates, the smaller campaigns, third parties, the rules are always bent in favor of the big money spenders and also the big money parties. That's what I'm saying when I ask you about the rules. Are you there?
Well, yeah, I'm here. And, you know, to answer that a little bit, you know why.
When I asked you that question, you know, I know you and I come from the same train of thought, so it's almost like a rhetorical question.
No, you're right.
I just wanted to get your opinion on that.
Well, my opinion is just, you know, after running my own campaigns, being campaign manager and media director in several state and federal campaigns, my thoughts has been, you know, those kinds of rules do need to change when it comes to not only campaign financing, but also IRS rules, because as you pointed out, there's nonprofits who won't even let candidates in. And if they do, they'll let selective candidates in the door and
everything.
Right,
exactly.
And, you know, as someone who, you know, has been going through a 501c3 status legal battle for a while, I just don't understand, you know, why we even have, like, 501c3 or 501c4s, because, you know, 3s cannot say anything about politics. It has to be education, but c4s can. And
right.
It's only because of legal definition, you know? So I guess even simple things like that need to change. You know, because we all know there are front groups that support Democrats and Republicans. The Heritage Foundation, the Brookings Institute, those things are think tanks. They don't directly give money to Democrats or Republicans, but they have people on staff, on a payroll that do, by happenstance, quote unquote, work for, you know, major Democrat and Republican leaders, you know? And you even have, like, schools like Liberty University that's a tax shelter for Pat Robertson, but you know he gives money to religious conservatives and everything.
Right.
So my point is those kinds of rules need to change, too. Because even
Go on, finish your
point.
No,
go ahead. My only point there, Stuart, is that a lot of rules need to change. It's not just about, you know, third parties and the two major parties coming in the same playing field. It's really about dismantling Citizens United. It's really about overhauling the IRS and a few other things.
Alex, back to what I was talking about, the lobbyists that we have in Washington, D.C. We have AIPAC, one of the most powerful single political lobby in Washington, D.C., was the main driving force behind the 2003 military invasion in Iraq by the Bush-Cheney administration. I mean, here's a war, and the illegal war, and now we're still suffering the repercussions. It's a war that has cost American people well over $2.5 trillion, and the total is still going. And here it was behind those candidates that were financed there into those offices, and of course we're talking about political groups such as AIPAC, political lobby, but we have the same thing when we look at Wall Street and many of the oil companies, and I always hear this protecting American interests. Mm-hmm. And when I think about protecting American interests, well, they're not protecting my interests, because the interest that they're protecting is their interest in those oil fields of Iraq and Iran,
right,
and Syria,
right,
and Libya. I don't have any interest in that. The reason why I don't have any interest is every time I go to the gas pump, they're soaking me. So I don't have any interest. But here we have back in 2003, we were launched into a war with Iraq, again, because we had a political action committee, AIPAC, which was the driving force behind not only the president at that time, but Congress, and mission accomplished. Mission was not accomplished. So,
right.
Whether we're talking about AIPAC or whether we're talking about Wall Street, we have a major problem here, Alex, when we're talking about the amount of monies that are being used to buy out our politicians, and is creating political havoc and economic turmoil for the people of this country. They're being bought out.
Mm-hmm.
Your comments?
You pretty much nailed on the head, Stuart. The only interests are the American people's interests. No, there's no interest when it comes to lobbyists, big oil, business unions, and the like. The only interests there are is the American people. There are. I just was talking about this on my radio show today, how the U.S. has just failed when it comes to working families. We're the only country, and we're a country among Papua New Guinea and Oman, who pretty much doesn't give anything to women when it comes to paid maternity leave, long-term or short-term paid sick days, anything. You know, those kinds of things are of the interest of the American people. There are students who have high debt and students who can't even go back to school as a second career option because we're spending too much money on defense and not enough on anything else. We have people on the street who can't even pay their medical bills or have the right amount of pharmaceuticals for their physical or mental disabilities they have. Those are the interests that we need to be fighting for, not about Exxon Mobil or, you know, what AFSCME or SEIU is doing and everything else. I mean, we have to be fighting for working class families, and the working class is the one that we need to be interested in, because that's what drives this country and the United States.
Exactly. I'm just going to take a short pause here, Alex. I just want to mention that we do have as our guest today on the Socialist Insight, we have Alex Cigneri. And Alex is joining our program today to discuss the people versus the corporations. And, Alex, I'd like to thank you once again for joining the program today.
Oh, no, thank you for, again, having me back on the show. I always enjoy talking with you.
I always enjoy it. It's the same here. Could you take probably around a minute? I want you to share a little bit about your program with our audience today.
Yes. My radio show is Out Front with me, AJ, in Chicago's AM 1680 Q4 radio. People in the country who's listening to your show can listen to me on the internet at www.QUE4.org. My show runs Monday through Friday, 1 to 3 p.m. Central Standard Time. And on my show, I talk about like a lot of insider baseball and politics and activism, and then I also talk about the arts, both. You know, I try to bring in up-and-coming artists or artists who've been around, you know, process for someone's artistic process, as well as, you know, discussing aesthetics and things of that nature. So it's, I like to think of my show as better than Terry Gross's show, but, you know, that's up for listeners' judgment.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you joining the program. I want to get a little bit more into Citizens United with you, Alex. And, you know, I look back at the election in 2000 when Gore was running against Bush. And then that, during that election, a critical decision was made where we had, in with a popular vote, we had Gore. He was leading. He was actually he was winning that campaign with the popular vote. And we had the Supreme Court made the decision. They stopped the counting there in Florida, and they were the ones that made the decision who the next president was. Mm-hmm. Now, what we can see, that was a very critical, crucial point in the electoral process here in this country, because we had a independent body, the courts, make a decision, and basically what they did is they pushed democracy completely to the side and say, we will make the decision, and this decision was made in the interest of the person that they had already, the person that basically the Washington establishment has supported. Now, we can see when we look at Citizens United, basically the courts did essentially the same thing in 2010. And Alex, I would like for you to share with our listeners what Citizens United is all about and what actually took place with the decision that they made in January of 2010. Could you share that with our listeners, please?
So, I mean, for those who don't know about Citizens United, the summation of it is as follows. Congress took up this. Well, as you said earlier, Citizens United was talking about how corporations, associations, or even labor unions have the First Amendment right because they look at those kinds of organizations as a quote-unquote person. So they have that free speech in order to what they can say about a certain candidate, and they also allowed to have opening up funds for them and everything, and they can say whatever they want. So you can have this corporation in Tokyo, Japan, and they could say,
right,
oh, yeah, we like Barack Obama, or we like Mitt Romney, or Gore, whomever. So it's pretty much what the Supreme Court allowed and what Congress allowed is to have this Wild West environment when it comes to the political landscape now. So instead of having a somewhat tight, controlled, regulated playing field, now the floodgates are open, and now anyone and anyone can speak to any person in any political party, you know, and I cannot think of any other international law that's an equivalent to this, because I think we're the only ones in the international community that has some sort of legislation.
We're the only one.
Yeah, so I mean, this is very unprecedented, and as you know and as others know, this has been fought all, since 2010, this has been fighting on.
2010.
And so, there's organizations like Move to Amend, who is, that kind of organization, and other organizations who want to really amend, if not abolish, Citizens United.
Now, what I find very interesting is if you look back at 2010, President Obama called it a major victory for big oil, victory for big oil, Wall Street banks, health insurance companies, and the other powerful interests that marshaled their power every day in Washington to drown out the voices of every American. This is what the president said. But in addition to the president making that statement, he basically jumped on the bandwagon and realizing that, the monies that need to be spent on political campaigns, Obama said, after in his writings, dissenting opinion, McCain and other critics said the ruling allows wealthy corporations and unions to have an unfair advantage in electing candidates to federal office. But Obama just came back and just said, that he was going to take advantage of it because it was just part of the process. Now, he didn't say it that way verbatim. But essentially what has happened with Citizens United, it has provided unlimited financial resources, mainly for the big money parties, because smaller independent candidates and small parties, third parties, they receive no benefits from these from the ruling that was made in by Citizens United. Now here is a court. You have even though the vote was 5-4 in favor of passing that. But here you had a conservative court pass a law that really worked toward the detriment of the political process here in this country. And as you mentioned, there's nowhere else in the world that they have any type of a process like what we see passed by Citizens United. Now, also as a result of that, and I want you to share a little bit about what super PACs, what they are, because super PACs came about as a result of that decision. Could you share a little bit about super PACs?
Well, before I get into that, let me give you one more background on Citizens United. If you recall, there was already an act in place in 2002 known as the McCain-Feingold Act, which is called the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, So that modified the FEC Act of 1971. Citizens United is a conservative 501c4 organization. But what really sparked Citizens United case is because Citizens United was jumping on Michael Moore during his Fahrenheit 9/11 documentary. And because of that, they were saying because of that movie, that is going to be possibly one of the linchpins for the Bush reelection campaign. And because of that, they said if someone like Michael Moore can do this political motive movie, then how come, even though they're not giving money to John Kerry or anyone else, why are we, is this being allowed, but, nonprofit organizations can do this? And this is what upset the whole Citizens United versus the FEC and everything. Now, your question was about super PACs and what that is. And so super PACs are technically known as independent expenditure only committees. And so super PACs may raise unlimited sums of money from corporations, unions, associations, and individuals that spends unlimited sums of overtly advocating for or against candidates. So They're also a 527 organization. There's, as of June of this year, June 23rd, there's over 1,000 super PACs in the United States. And there, some of these are more like American Crossroads, which is Carl Groves' organization, which is under scrutiny with Scott Walker now in Wisconsin. There's the Mississippi Conservatives that supports Cochran. There's Women Vote. SEIU is considered a super PAC. The Tea Party Patriots is one of them. So there's, like, some of the major ones that we all know and love. You know, and there's some, like,
1,000. Yeah. I didn't even realize the number had swelled to that.
Yeah. You know, and some of them, like I said, there's some of them just started super PACs just for specific candidates, you know. But there's also, like, Human Rights Campaign Equality Votes, you know. So there are super PACs. So you even have organizations that were 501c4s are now 527s. And they can, and they made it that switch so they can put all their money into candidates, which is why I wrote an article for the Independent Voter Network when Obama said he's going to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. My article was about, is he doing this genuinely to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell? Or is he doing it because of Victory Fund, which is a 527 super PAC that gave them money?
Right.
Because as you said earlier, money talks, you know?
Right,
and
exactly.
So is Obama, in his interest, really interested in reforming and, you know, providing the rights that everyone in the LGBTIQ community needs, or is he doing it with the dollars and cents? And I'm of the latter of opinion.
Right. And I think, I believe I would have to agree with you on that. Just sharing some of the differences with what independent candidates, like, as I mentioned, in 2012, I ran as a political candidate for this with the Socialist Party USA, but it mentions under political action committees, candidates, and this is with the Federal Elections Committee Commission, the FEC, candidates and traditional candidates, candidate committees can accept $2,500 from individuals per election. That means they can take in $5,000 a year, half in the primary and half in the general election. Now, when you look at super PACs, the difference is super PACs, though, super PACs have no limitations on who contributes or how much they contribute. They can raise as much money from corporations, unions, and associations as they please and spend unlimited amounts on advocating for the election or defeat of the candidate of their choice. Unlimited amounts. So when you look at democracy and, you know, elections, basically it's all about the money now. Alex, it's all about the money, because you have these super PACs, and as you mentioned, this you said it's over 1,000, correct?
Right, 1,075 to be exact.
And growing. So you have well over 1,000 super PACs out there, and they're able to spend countless billions of dollars to support these candidates. And what they're doing is they're spending this money for special interests. Is when you talk about special interests, especially promoting the interests of Wall Street, billionaires around the world, big corporations, big oil, insurance corporations. That's what they're doing. And this is what we saw essentially when we saw Obamacare when it became it was in 2010, but essentially, we have seen big money in legislation such as Obamacare, which is not to the benefit of working people, but it has been more to the benefit of the insurance industry. When we see these wars that are taking place, these wars are taking place because of the military-industrial complex. And also, when these wars take place, it's because of protecting the interests of the big oil giants and also securing those mineral resources of other countries. So essentially, when we look at super PACs and the monies that they're spending, it's to make certain that they ensure that the candidates are there in Washington to protect the interests not of the American people, but it's to protect the interests, the special interest groups in that are on Wall Street and also big corporations. So essentially, when you look at this, Alex, I mean, it's corruption in politics to the core.
It is. And let me pose the question to you. You've ran, as you said, a few campaigns, both state and federal level and everything, and you've been with SP USA for a while. I guess the question begs, you know, as, you know, from one third-party guy to another, what does this mean for us other than, you know, we want to have ballot access and we want campaign finance reform and all that? Do we play the same game in order for people to hear us out, or do we just, you know, play ball in the junior league, if you will, and just, you know, get the few votes that we can and get the minimal exposure we can in order to get our message across? Because, you know, I've always been the advocate that, you know, we have to play the same game, but we can still do different strategies while playing the same game. Our friend Mimi, who just ran a state assembly race in the 62nd in California, he ran as an open socialist, but he only did it just to talk about issues, knowing that he wasn't get that high enough votes, he still ran. So do we still do those kinds of things and, you know, have PACs, have, you know, create 501c4s as front groups so they can support us, or do we stay on our principles and go forward? Because I still think you can be principled but still play the same games as other people do it. I may be wrong.
Well, you know, when I look at this, Alex, I mean, I think about, you know, when you're running a campaign, you know, people, they go and sit down at their computers, they look at their cell phones, you see ads sort of popping up everywhere. When I was running as a presidential candidate for the Socialist Party USA, you look at Facebook, I mean, here's Barack Obama. Actually, he, right from the start, he got in bed with Facebook, and he was popping up everywhere. And here, again, you have, that's big money. When you look at the monies that are going in, and when you say play the same game, they, you know, you may play the same game, but you're not playing it, you know, when there's cost that is involved, you don't have nowhere near the amount of money that is necessary to play the game. For instance, to run as a presidential candidate now in the United States, you're not even a serious contender unless you're spending $300 million. How are you going to raise $300 million just to get in the game? You know, let alone spend $1 billion on your campaign. That's the cost of playing the game. It's like when I used to go to Disneyland when I was a teenager. I mean, you know, you could pay for the A, B, C, D, or E ride. Most of the times, you know, people would go in and they would pay for the A or B ride because they couldn't afford the E ride, which costs like four times as much as the A ride. So that's when you talk about cost. The other thing I want to mention, Alex, is, you know, when I was running as a candidate, I went to several states, and when we were raising funds here, the big money parties, the two corporate parties, they're raising millions of dollars. They have people that are coming and paying $30,000 a plate. Here, when I look at many of the independent candidates, Alex, they're passing the hat where, you know, people are putting like $2 and $3 and, you know, maybe $10. And at the end of, you know, raising funds for any particular visit, they may raise, they say, well, we raised $175. You know, again, that's, you know, you just pay for the A ticket. You didn't get the E ticket. You see what I'm saying? So, Alex, when you talk about that, we should be able, I think if you're going to be in that game, you need to play it, but you got to play it with money. How do you do that?
Well, I guess I'm reminded of what the Green Party of Canada did, what their strategy was, and they had a big national meeting about this, is in order to get a Green to be a member of Parliament, they chose one person and put all their resources in that one person. And Elizabeth May, out of just north of Vancouver, British Columbia, they put all their time, energy, resources, both financially and social capital, into her, went all over her little area to be a member of Parliament and won. And it was very effective and all that. So, I mean, there's examples like that. So, I mean, it could be the same, like, if you, you know, back when you ran in 2012, if SPUSA wants to say, we're going to put all of our time and effort into just Stewart's campaign, and we're going to put all of our monies in, we're going to get some of our networks and say it's Stewart, no one else, we're not going to have anyone else run but Stewart, so that way Stewart can at least, you know, have, you know, the resources he needs to run for president and everything, as well as to, you know, get the attention, you know, and even if that attention means getting, you know, 0.7% of the vote, which is still huge, mind you, for a third-party candidate to get 0.7% of the general election in the United States.
Right. Well, when I look at some of the big money, I was just mentioning just at the beginning of our program some of the monies that have gone into campaigns. I think back when Ross Perot, when he was running for president, and he launched his campaign, and many of us, you know of that campaign. Were you aware of the happenings during that campaign yourself, Alex?
I remember Ross Perot when he ran, you know, against Bush.
Well, he used his own money to be able to promote his campaign. And you know, it's something when you have money to throw a party, right? The more money you have to throw the party, it's probably going to be a lot more successful. You know, you're going to get a lot more people interested. I went to his campaign office in Van Nuys, and, I mean, literature was all over the place. You had, you know, crowds of people in there supporting the campaign because, you know, the money was flowing. And, you know, it's like, you know, if you're wealthy, you got a lot of friends. If you're poor, you know, everyone tried to avoid you, you know. But, you know, during his campaign, I mean, the monies were flowing. And, you know, this is one thing that, you know, getting into the game, just speaking to that point that you made a few minutes ago, you know, I believe it's essential that, you know, you do things three different ways. It's either time, money, or effort, you know, one of those three things. And if you organize, you can put in the time and the effort. So even though we're dealing with big money, you know, we have to organize our time very effectively, and we have to put forth effort. One of the things, is I won't even mention the state in regards to my campaign. Here we had representatives for the party, you know, in that state that had the opportunity almost 3 months to organize a campaign just to collect 800 signatures. 3 months to collect 800 signatures. And here they put off from 3 months down to 3 weeks while they were collecting signatures for another individual. And I was saying, well, why are you out collecting signatures for one person? Why don't you just collect signatures from the campaign? No, yours is going to be easier to collect. But the thing is, they could have put forth the effort and the time, and they could have been successful. And subsequently, our campaign was not on the ballot because they were not able to collect the signatures in time. Alex, when I ran for mayor of Los Angeles in 1989, and it seemed like it was a daunting task, that I had to collect somewhere between 1,000 to 1,500 signatures to qualify to be on the ballot there in Los Angeles. And during the first month of my campaign, we had our campaign meetings, but then it got to the point where individuals wouldn't even show up, let alone show up to go canvassing. So I was on a mission, Alex, that I went door to door in Los Angeles, knocking on doors and telling people, I need your vote. I'm running as a candidate for mayor of Los Angeles, and I need your signature to get on the ballot. Many of those people say, well, I'm not going to vote for you, but I give you my signature. And I still had over 1,200 signatures that qualified to get me on the ballot. So, Alex, the point that I'm making is, sure, it takes big money to get into the big politics. But if you don't have the big money, then you need to be organized. You have to be organized. People have to put in time, and we're not even doing that. Because, you know, that is the least that we can do. And when I look at many of the third parties, we talk about what we need to do to deal with the political process here in this country and being able to contend. Alex, I don't know if we're ready for that game yet. What is your opinion?
Well, you know, I mean, going back to the organizing part you were just talking about, as you know, August 1st to the 3rd here in Chicago, SPUSA is going to have a national organizing conference, you know. So, I mean, things like that where people can come together and discuss and learn from other people on how to organize better when it comes to campaigning, whether it be electoral or issues and everything, or just, you know, getting organized in the streets or what have you. So there's things like that and others. Outlets out there to educate and train people to organize. I hear what you're saying, and I know what Green Party of Canada did is an exception to the rule because,
right.
You know, they do have disposable money, unlike other national, international political parties that I know. However, you know, it's just a matter of if we're talking about electoral campaigning, then the question still begs, do we even run on electoral campaigns?
Good question.
The limitations that we have. And I like what Mimi did, you know, run as an open socialist, even though he knew what the reality of running in California was. I'm all for that, you know. I'm all for that as well as organizing with organizations that understand, whether it be SP or whomever else, stands on the same issues that we fight for. And then once people recognize certain people or certain organizations that are actually doing really good, decent work, then I think that kind of social capital will always trump financial capital. Now, when I say that, people look at me and tilt their head a little differently, but I'm still of the belief that if you have a vast social capital, that will always trump financial capital.
Yeah, I agree with that. I definitely agree. I just want to make a quick pause. We have just a few more minutes. We have Alex J. Signeri. He's joining our program today. And today we've been discussing the people versus the corporations. And we were talking about big money in U.S. politics. And Alex, once again, I really have enjoyed having you on our program today. Alex, just one other thing, and then I want you to have the last word, is that, you know, I appreciate the fortitude of certain groups. Just recently, we had a group that started out several weeks ago, and it was marchers against big money in politics arrested in state capital, and that was the state capital of Sacramento, California. And these individuals, it was approximately 300 of them actually 14 were arrested. They went from Los Angeles all the way to Sacramento, which was approximately 450 miles a march. It was a 99 rise That's the name of the group, 99 Rise. And again, they were looking at taking the big money out of politics, and that was their mission. Now, I really can admire what they did, the march, and also putting forth the effort to bring attention to this critical problem. And it is a problem because what it is doing is creating a void. And when I say a void in the democratic process, because when I think about that, we really don't have any democracy in this country. I just want you to comment on that group, taking that, on that mission, what they did, Alex.
Well, on that same vein, there's an organization I've worked with, National Alliance Against Race and Political Repression, where on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, we marched on against police crimes in downtown Chicago, where we went to both City Hall and the Federal Building, And it's organizations like that. This last year, on the 50th anniversary of March. So it's organizations like that, the one you just mentioned and others, who do that kind of work, movement work, as well as, getting organizations network together, building certain coalitions together. I appreciate that more than saying, come to us, join our member, be a member, get involved, and, we'll do all the work, And I just don't appreciate that as much anymore than, let's sit at the table, strategize, how can we do this, what can we do, and go forward. Because I think that kind of work is more important than giving your dollars to this organization, because I view that as more profiting injustice than anything else.
Alex, I'm just going to make a couple of announcements, and then I would like for you to give the last word on our program today. Once again, I would like to thank Alex Signeri for joining the program today. I want to mention in a couple of weeks we're going to be changing the name of the program to Turn Left with Stuart Alexander. The program is going to have the same format, the same time, and we're looking forward to having our listeners to join us as we continue with this weekly program. It will be Turn Left, Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. And remember, the program will air 4 o'clock Pacific and 7 o'clock Eastern. And, Alex, we have just a couple of minutes. I just want you to just mention once again your programming, how people can be able to listen to you on the Internet, and say the last word, please.
Well, my show is Out Front with AJ, and I'm on Chicago's AM 1680 Q4 radio, and those nationally and internationally can hear me at www.que4.org. And Stuart, if you don't mind me plugging my organization, if that's okay.
Oh, please do.
My organization is the Foundation for United Front. We're on the executive director, where essentially is doing exactly what I was just mentioning to you is we do coalition building and networking with organizations. We also do a lot of educational programming, and in the near future, we're going to provide financial assistance to grassroots organizations.
And would you like to have the last word on our program today?
The only thing I want to say, again, Stuart, thank you for having me on the show. I'm looking forward to more discussions like this with you on your new named show. But the only thing I would like to say is, for those who are listening, pay attention to what's going on around you, looking at the organizations that are fighting the good fight, and also learn from people who have been in the hole and got back out, because those are the people who are still fighting, and those are the people you really need to be paying attention to.
Thanks again, Alex, for joining the program, and we'll be looking forward to having you to join us on a future program of Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. And once again, I always like to thank Ruth Ann for making all of this possible. We'll be looking forward to having our listeners to join us next week on The Socialist Insight. Thanks again. Everyone have a good night.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. I'm Ra, and Ken Withrow is our facilitator, moderator, and here he is, along with Karen.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
How are you? So, I absolutely don't remember how we left it off on Monday, but we are talking about race and its social ramifications, and really the pointlessness of the subject as far as how it only exists because we've made it there as a separatist thing. And we left off on a really good point, and I don't remember what it was at all. Do you remember? Does anyone remember, or should we just dive in blind? Because it's fun. It's a great subject, but...
Did Karen have something that she was going to say about that, or was it called?
Not really. Not really. I think we were. It was
okay.
It's a great subject, and I agreed it was social economic.
It must have been Copel then, because
yeah,
there was
yeah.
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 Is she with
it
us?
It was her.
And she's not with us right now.
Yeah, she's not here right now. Yeah, so, like, I think we left the torch in her hand. She finished off with a really good point, and everyone was like, ah, and then the damn clock goes off. You know, we start hearing the music, and we're like, no, because I think we really started getting into the nitty-gritty of it, which, I don't know. Karen, you seem to have a point going, so maybe...
Do I?
I'll trust you. Maybe you can start the bike.
Well, the title was interesting because we had race and the social contract, and there's sort of an update to the concept of the social contract in that it really is becoming economic echelons. It's the dividing line, not necessarily...
Yeah.
I mean, race, I know that people with, you know, issues about race would maybe differ with me, and I respect that, but... we really have things now, class warfare, on very, very economic base, so like what's your income base or your prospects or that sort of thing. And I've been looking at that this week in different forums. I went actually back to quite, in 1956, I watched a video from the president of a college that I went to, actually cleaned his office, and he was a strict capitalist. And... wow, that was painful hear what he had to say about just broad terms of what capitalism was when we're now at the point now where there's quite a bit of revelation about the manipulations of, like, Forex and LIBOR, and the entire system was really rigged. And, we're at that point now where the proof is in the pudding, or the social experiment has now played itself out, and we have a highly unequal system, and it's just getting that way every day. So... that was kind of one experience I had this week.
That's kind of funky because I've not really spent a lot of time digging into the start of this idea. You know, I've always looked at it as being one giant picture, and I've never looked at, like, yeah, when you get into the real, the gears in the present mechanism, it really ultimately, as we keep ending up back on, it all ties to money at some point. And not really money so much as the binding of that system and how, it's fueled this capitalist corporate, giant, and it's splitting and separating into class warfare like we're seeing. And it's kind of funny because I've always kind of thought it's all, you know, it's been there since the get-go in different forms, but each one had a different support network that kept it alive for whatever, 1,000 years, 500 years, whatever, 100 years, and each one collapsed under different forms of weight. You know, you go to the Roman Empire, blah, 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 and now we get into this, the last 100 years were very different from any of those, because first off, the rapid growth of control, because the technology that's come through has allowed for us to do things that they only dreamt of back when they were taking over the world. You know, it's easy to take over the world when you had an army and you walked in and you scared a village into submission and you just continually did that. People weren't warning each other, talking to each other. They didn't have weapons. They didn't have phones, radios, computers, laws, regulations. Those armies weren't funded by people that maybe owned the land the village was on, so now they couldn't raid that one because you're going to ruin that guy's funding, and so he's not going to pay you. And like the infrastructure in the industrial cloud that we're in has, one, caused us to grow insanely fast. This class warfare, this taking over of the planet, it's happened in a very short time frame amidst a lot of confusion and many attempts, you know, the Nazis, you name it, you know. But in the end, you look at this, it's also going to collapse under that same weight, and it's already collapsing. It's like you said, the social experiment's worn itself out. And I think that the same rates of growth is pretty integral to the rate of collapse. And it's forcing itself to change. Like it's like we did the entire project on hyperdrive, you know, we're just like, wow. And now it's going to slow down with that same kind of speed and hit the wall. And, you know, we can use all the tags of race, gender, everything, but in the end it was all about separating everybody so that you could collapse them and control them, which back then they were already separated way back when it was easier to take over a planet. And even then, you don't even know what they took over, really. You know, they took over the people that fought to each other. But did the Romans take over the middle of Guam? You know, were they in Hawaii? Did they go to Alaska? So they really didn't take over the world. The Roman Empire really was not. It was just the world that was communicating with each other. You can't even say it was a literate world, you know.
That's the Mediterranean to Europe, basically.
Yeah, you know, it really wasn't that big of a takeover, but we look at it as they ran the world because that's the part of the world that was sharing notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
Which is really, kind of funny to think about, you know, because I always looked at them as, like, you know, Alexander the Great or something, you know. Like, these guys, known world conquerors. They really didn't do much. They did less than the Nazi Party, probably, you know?
I don't know. I have the notation, too, of the part of history I'm kind of, like, studying right now is the Pelasgian Empire, which was completely erased. I mean, it's pre-Greek, so we don't really even know that there was a European empire of great influence just before the Greek Empire, and we're just now beginning to discover that, because they did a pretty good job of a term called synchronicity. They were able to kind of homogenize culture, and I think America has called itself the melting pot, so it's tried to do the same thing, but they kept the differences were utilized in economic decision-making. So you're right, they pit this versus that. Family history-wise, we had Native American people who passed for white because they didn't want to go to the reservation. They wanted to be able to work the plot of land that they have. So they would say, oh, yeah, I'm dark Irish or something. And
yeah. And
were able to stay on their land, because what kind of happens is people try to figure out what's their best, you know, play economically, macro, you know, microeconomically in their own life. And and there was those prejudices of different groups that came over. When the Catholic type people came over, they were they were discriminated against by the Protestant type people. So it's this pachinko machine where we kind of end up culturally. But the idea was you were supposed to become, you know, an American and kind of homogenize your culture in this kind of contrived synchronistic culture that we thought we had. And it was more for an economic decision-making of where you belonged for the outside to impose on you than something that was really healthy for your family or your identity, or even for America as a whole is better off with diversity. So we're really at a breast. Yeah, like I said, we're at this very rapidly accelerated system that's quite mechanized. Actually, our economic system is quite mechanized, with computers doing the buying for the brokers that used to be people. You know. I feel like we really are the 99% with the 1%. I mean, we might have this cultural difference or that cultural difference, but we have a common, you want to say enemy or something, or a common group here that is using whatever differences it can to its advantage, whether the energy is for it or against it, they can use it. That's seriously difficult for wherever you fall in the socioeconomic cultural place.
Mm-hmm. Now, that makes sense. Yeah, I think that, and once again, like we had brought up, like, race, once collapsed, the term is collapsed, and we embrace social differences and utilize them like that, I think that the subject itself, the concept, is, it's going to dissipate. I mean, it'll still rear a head here and there, because nothing really goes away swiftly, you know? I mean, the system that's really keeping it fueled will die and change. We'll say not die, but it will transform. It's going to collapse into something. And this, you know, like we could call it, like you could use it on spiritual terms, but in the end, it's basic, you know, like a lot of people miss the fact that nature and the universe, same laws preside, you know, evolution, the basic. It will pick the logical path. The thing is, we like to assume what the logical path is. You know, survival of the fittest. That's not the case universally. That may be the case for the a wolf in a certain habitat, in a certain, you know, situation, and then base a whole theory on it. But really, what it is things adapt. Things change with the flow of what's going on. Now, spiritually, you say, you know, things flow with the energy coming through it. But if you want to get very layman, things adapt to operate smoother. You know, we naturally all act like water, and we find the easiest path. Thing is, we seem to think we know what the easiest path is. But we don't, because we're a bunch of egotistical bastards, you know? I mean, that is human nature. Mm-hmm. We think we know everything. We don't. And so, like, this is prime example, like you're saying, like, the logical path for humanity to go is synchronicity, to come together. Why? Because the differences together make a very accurate, wonderful machine. And, oh, here you go. I got a movie analogy. You guys ready? Has anyone seen the new Lego movie?
No.
Is that not this subject?
Oh my God.
It's out for rent right now. My kids, we watched it yesterday. And it was everything we're talking about, everything. And it was crazy in this kid's movie, and it talks about changing the world and that everyone has the potential of doing it. And the hero in the story was the plainest, most boring, stupid person possible. Literally, that's what he was depicted in the movie, being a Lego guy. And he ended up being the hero, and the hero ended up inspiring everyone to be the hero, and everybody changed the world with their own insights and their own input, period, and then the world changes. And it was Will Ferrell as God in the movie, because he's the dad of the kid, and a really cool movie. But it all just took every single topic that is really hitting humanity right now. The world's in trouble. Shit's hitting the fan, we're a bunch of idiots, and we don't know how to fix the mess we made. And it was saying what everybody who's really aware is saying. It takes the individual to fix it, because the individual is the source of the problem. You can't blame the group, you blame the individual. So you start removing these... The Lego movie is about Legos. It's a brilliant movie. Yeah, the Lego movie. You could rent it on Netflix right now, and it was It was insane. Like, me and Julie both were like, I can't believe they just did that in a movie for kids. Like, that was brilliant. And it was just, it literally is just indoctrinated a positive thing into children by saying every single person has the power to change the world. And you can alter the course of your future as an individual. And then you come together as a team, you can make wonderful things happen, because great things happen when everyone works together. What's the issue we have right now? A bunch of great things in certain people's opinions can't happen because they came together and they pretty much locked us in a cage. Okay, so flip the coin. Same concept, same thinking, same people, same stuff. Well, not same people. Us, same stuff. But you use that and you use it for the benefit of humanity. Same tools. All of a sudden, people can make those changes. And the key thing was, do you think that they, as individuals, are separating each other? No, they're looking at assets, and they're utilizing assets for the gain that they have set before them. So we should be doing the same thing. Well, what's the key thing here? Well, our assets are that we are all together, if we could come together. So let's stop separating. Well, like we have just spent this entire show so far that we've been doing, we've been talking about separatist mechanisms. Why? Well, because that's all they are, period. And we've just kind of been attacking them. I mean, I don't even think we got into the nitty-gritty of any of them, really, but we looked at them and we approached them. We got pretty good, you know, like depth in there of like, okay, this is what we see, and then we look at solutions. Ultimately, the key thing with it, with race, with all this, is it's all an illusion that we fabricated just as much as they fabricated. And when we have these kinds of talks, we're empowering ourselves to disengage from the system. And then the more people that start seeing that, and it's simple. I mean, like, we'd love to complicate things. And honestly, it's evolution. It's basic, simple laws of nature. Right now, we are finding the easier path. And it's very difficult because we made a huge obstacle course. But like water, we will ultimately flow with it because we're trying to go with the flow energy, the easier path, instead of fighting, which is what we've been kind of thinking we could save ourselves through the fight, through, you know, get enough money, you'll make it. You know, we believe the manifesto, you know, and now we're seeing, you know, the manifesto fell apart. The social experiment is collapsing, and we're like, oh, shit. You know, and we still haven't let go because we're thinking all the money I invested into the manifesto, all the time, all the indoctrinations, all the
dreams.
Huh?
The dreams.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and all we got to do is just stop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you let go of the handlebars and just go, look, I'm done, man, and I'm going to let this thing go down the hill on its own course. You're going to realize that all that baggage you've been dragging slowed you down. You let it go. You literally will be fine, you know. And the things we're scared of are still those, the ankle bracelets keeping us, you know, locked into the prison, you know. And it's neat, man, that we have the history we do know that we can say is mildly accurate. Shows these things in some form or another, that it is feasible to work these ways. But we don't want to look at those things. We want to look at the Alexander the Greats, the Roman Empires. You know, we want to look at the things that used fiat currency and used debt and used power and didn't work together. Because why would we want to even let somebody notice the possibility of a flaw in the system? We could just say they hadn't perfected it. And keep teaching that, you know? But really, if anyone knew that there were societies that didn't do that and they thrived, well, people would question what we're doing now more. And then what? You know, all of a sudden, you know, that dude that's pushing the red button, that's killing the little Jewish kids in the gas chamber, is now aware of what happens when he pushes the button. The guy might stop pushing the button, you know? And then what? Now you just threw a big monkey wrench in your plan. And that's, I mean, it's funny. Like, I got in this talk just the other day. with a guy, very heavy atheist, kind of new to the fact that the world is screwed up. And so he's just now learning a lot, you know. And it was, I threw a post out there about the anomalies, you know, that they're finding that are dating like 400 million years old, the hammers and things, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I think I stole it from you, Karen. And
That's funny.
And, oh, dude, it sparked this, like, talk. And the guy's like, well, he dove into the opinion of the article writer instead of looking at the fact, dude, you know, and he's adhering to the scientific process, he says, by saying, you know, you know, without, you know, proper data or whatever, these guys aren't scientists. And I'm like, no way. And I found an article was posted that actually showed dates and reports from scientists on these specific things. So I was able to give them, like, real data and go, no, these were scientists doing this, and the stuff got buried. Well, why did they bury it? And I'm trying to, like, go, this isn't a conspiracy theory. They literally don't want a challenge to something that makes them money. It's that simple. It's just that simple. There is.
I got into anomaly research because of a gentleman by the name of Charles Fort, and you can go to the library and probably check out the book, The Complete Works of Charles Fort. And part of why that's important to kind of look at that is this gentleman collected newspaper clippings of stories all over the place of all these weird things that would happen, like frogs raining from the sky, and, you know, strange things being, giant bones being found, and all of that, these anomalies. But there was the problem that we have is, in order to make our corporately approved science, by the way, because most of our science departments in school are corporately backed, so the basic idea is, like, we're on it, you keep buying stuff. That's kind of the basic idea of science right now.
Yeah.
In order for that to work, they have to throw out so much. And this at the beginning of the Book of the Damned, which is one of Charles Fort's works, he said, there's so much that they throw out to make the mainstream story work that it's ridiculous. It's way too much information that just, you say it's an anomaly. And, you know, we have a crop circle season. We have you coming every year. How's that an anomaly? I would say that's what I call a normally. Like, normally in
I threw
England,
another one
every
at them.
Spring, they have crops.
Yeah, no. Still, people are like, oh, you can, you know, because, see, people don't research enough to throw their counter to it because there's so much happening. It's insane. You have to be like a nerd like us and just, like,
yeah,
you know, obsessively dig. I threw one at him, though, that was really, really, like, I think one of my favorites, because you cannot argue this one. And that is when Stephen Hawking had to fold on the black holes. The guy had, you know, 3 books on the bestseller list, made a full career and doctorate on black hole science, and they're garbage. They literally are garbage. There is no way that they are accurate. Now, it doesn't mean that something isn't over there, but it is not the black hole. And there are so many scientists going up against this, and they're getting less and less flack. Well, there you go. That was something where everybody applied all this money, all this time, and all this stuff into that. I mean, shit, I have a degree looking at that, you know, like, my best reading was involved in that, and I have to toss it out. And why? Well, because it was taught as fact. Why? Well, like you said, universities are corporatized. They need to make money because then they can, everybody's happier when they're making money, and they forgot about education and the pursuit of knowledge, which means it's a theory, and you teach it as that and not fact. I mean, you know, like, what's his name? Neil deGrasse Tyson. The guy's not an astrophysicist. Yet I just read on a movie jacket, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about the universe. He focuses on black holes. He was a teacher, and he made a living advocating that Pluto was not a planet and got famous. He's a great personality, awesome guy, but he's a puppet, a talking head for the industry. Why? Well, because people love him. And that was it. But he's not what they say he is. Now, in the end, what's going to happen with the whole black hole thing? It's going to dissipate. I mean, shit, Einstein spent all, like, the last 10 years of his life, roughly, if not more, telling people the theory of relativity was garbage, that he wasted his life, and that it was not provable.
Well, they didn't even just keep going. I think this is a good thing to talk about. Go ahead, finish. Sorry.
Oh, I was gonna. They kept going, like you said. Why did they keep going? Well, all these careers were built off of a facet of that. All of them. You know, any cosmologist rooted everything on the theory of relativity, which was the core of using redshift to measure the velocity of stars. Well, if relativity's off, then redshift isn't accurate. And so, therefore, we don't know a damn thing about our universe. We only have theories. Nothing wrong with that pursuit. We got very far with it. We were able to calculate, which means we were pretty close on some stuff, you know? If you're close, then you're on a path that's possibly correct or near it, but it wasn't accurate, so you can't teach it as fact. And that was what I had to use with this guy. I was like, look, they're saying humanity evolved over 400 whatever thousand years. Well, it's based on the fact that it's based on this theory and the fact that they have recorded history. And so they're like, this is where it occurred because we got this, 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 and this. But you find this stuff, these tools, these anomalies that throw a kink in it, and you look at, holy shit, look at what HarperCollins published that year. Look at the movies that are out there, the documentaries. Look at the universities and their income. Look at the fact that those people from the universities invested in those books and movies and then those guys' research and invest, you know, like the web of connections that get severed or at least suffer in their eyes because it's based on the fact that they are teaching these things as fact and not theory. They got to push it that way to get the money in to do more stuff to promote it and make it more popular. And the sad thing is if we just all were like, I'm cool with the fact that this is a theory, I'm cool with the fact that we still don't know shit, then we wouldn't have the issues we have today. And we wouldn't have things like the study of race and this guy creating race. You know, the separatist stuff would be a lot, because people would be more knowledgeable. They would be more aware. But there's my soapbox. I'm going to step down because I'm talking a lot. I just realized I was going
I'm going to jump over to a different branch of science, economic science and computer science, because the other thing I was reading up on this week was economic theories and also a concept that's in computer theory called open source. And open source is a concept that's basically given us our Internet. We have proprietary operating systems would be like Windows or Microsoft-based. But we have another operating system called Linux, which is open source, which means all the people using it all together create it, and it's a commons. So it doesn't cost anything. And my laptop was getting funky, so it's now on Linux and running very well compared to what it was before because it's a real robust operating system. And most of the computer servers where everyone's data lives on the Internet is on Linux machines or open source. Well, that concept is a return back to the commons, where there used to be common areas, and we've done a reversal of that in the world economy where we've privatized things. So now we have things that used to be the commons that now belong to somebody, and now they're making it not accessible or making it accessible to just a few and the privileged. So this concept is beginning to break out of computer science into the concept of open source everything, where we begin to think of community property, to think of intellectual property, to think of our education system like you were just talking about, and begin to apply open source principles to it, which would kind of, you know, what we have now is this large machine that's been built by the proprietary monetary system of education, of media, of all of that, and where we can see like a really good example of an open source project that is robust is like Wikipedia. We used to have, scholarly articles written for Britannica and some of the other, you know, large encyclopedias. Now we have Wikipedia, which it's the Wild West. It really is. If you know anything about a topic, sometimes it's appalling to read a Wikipedia article. If you know something about it, then you know who's, like, controlling that page. But it's written by everyone who's involved with it, you know, who's in that writing and researching level, and they have discussions and wars and, you know, try to find the most way to put something in any particular article in the kind of the most lowest common denominator kind of way. But this is beginning to break out into economic ideas about community, and it could be used for business, for commons-based business ideas. So it's very interesting. So if people want to look that up, open source everything would be a good place to start to see how concepts like that can kind of reverse this machine. I mean, if you thought of our economic systems as a machine, it's a rusty one that's fixing to die and not run anymore. I mean, it's really run its course because it's based on old science, old thinking, and Ken, you knew my dad. And my dad, when I was a little kid, I said, I want to have all the money in the world. So he talked me through the fallacy of that. He said, okay, you have all the money in the world now. You can't buy anything because there's no factories to make the products that you would buy in the store. You know, and he kind of walked me through kind of why that's a problem.
Nice.
Be an oligarch of the world, you know. That's a problem, is we really do have that happening. And literally, at a certain point, if they've got that much, quote-unquote, money or, you know, numbers in a bank account somewhere, it actually drops in value. Anything that they had as a collector's item drops in value. Anything they have, because they have no one to sell it to. It can only maintain its value if the resource is moving. If the thing is flowing, then the value can go up, because if the demand drops, then the price drops, especially auctionable items. So we have this horror going on that most people don't know about, is that we have 2013 manufactured cars that are being warehoused in giant parking lots and not being put on the market, because if they flooded the market with all these cars, when the demand is low, the cars would drop down to a price so low they wouldn't be able to be financed for the banks, and the banks wouldn't be able to make money on car loans. So they'd rather pull all these brand new freaking cars off the, this article I read just had parking lot after parking lot after parking lot of brand new spanking vehicles that I bet a lot of people would like to have that were off market because they can't make money on them. The bank can't make money on them. So we're in this weird place with the economy.
That is really, it's like the housing market. It's the same thing. Like, all the vacant houses and it's because everybody is, like you said, they're trying to milk everything they can out of it, but so we've hit this weird spot, and maybe this is those collapsing points. You know, you have the debt-to-income ratio of the Fed, you know, that is, like I had mentioned, that scientist, I still can never remember his name, but he was, you know, studied fiat currency societies and their collapses, and he said that we are at that point, you know, we're right there, we're like really close to it, to where there's no salvaging, the boat is completely upside down. And the issue is the collapse, you have to kill, the infrastructure has to collapse with it, you know, so like you said, like if there is no cash in the hands of the people to purchase these goods, there is no flow of cash, therefore there's no flow of power. And the one thing is, and it's funny, it's like by default of the system, it creates a class warfare. And by default of a class warfare, they separate and you become a fiefdom, or you end up, you know, you end up in a dictatorship, or you end up in something where it is absolute in both ends. Extremes, lack of power and extreme of power, and then you end up with one of them, always the extreme lack because it's larger in number, will eventually take over that as soon as they are pushed to that point. And here, and in society in general, you don't need violent uprisings to collapse in a government anymore. You don't need to fight with weapons to do it. You literally can just strip them of their power, because one thing we don't realize is they laid all of their power in our hands. That's what we're talking about right now. We totally have their balls in our court. And all we have to do is stop dribbling. Literally, like put a rag under your chin. No, I mean, you know, but stop bouncing their balls, you know? Stop playing their game. And they don't even exist anymore. There is nothing to take over. And it's so simple and easy, but, like, people are not allowed to find out that all these things they feel you should be dependent on are accessible. That's where, you know, they're burying and hiding. They're keeping us separated. They're saying, well, you can't do this or you can't do that because you're this or you're not this or whatever. When all in all, that whole indoctrination, it's everybody facilitating their own little piece of the pie. And it's, you know, like a giant machine where it's all covering its own butt. But the problem is it's, you know, once again, going back to the original thing of it's the snake eating its own tail. There's only so much snake. And it's ate a lot of itself, man. And it's just going to be this head pretty soon sitting there. And then you just kick it out of the way and keep going down the path. But we're right there. We are literally right there. I don't know how long right there is, you know, but you could feel it because of the fact that these discussions are so easy now because we can tie information together. You know, we can find the giant skeletons and the weird orbs that are 400 million years old and go, seriously, it's either this or you're telling me that stratification and carbon dating isn't right. And if that's the case, then everything you're teaching me is false. So which is it? You know, like, that's what these things prove. They throw a kink in these systems. So you either have to deny everything, which then falsifies everything, or you have to go, there you go. What do you do with that? And then what they do, they don't know what to do. So what do? They bury it. They hide it. They smother it. They collapse people's careers, you know, whatever they can do, because it challenges one little slip. One realization and you stop pushing the red button, you know, you stop hating your neighbor who's colored differently, or you stop degrading somebody who has breasts and a vagina because you were taught you should, and all of a sudden you realize, well, if that's wrong there, what's the chances of everything else that's hinged on, near, or around it wrong too? And you realize it's high. The chances are very high, and you can't, you know, what do you do then with that information? It's I don't know.
It puts a plausible doubt, you know, in what you've been told, and the reason why that's good is because if you're knee-deep into it like I am as far as study, you realize that first of all, we have something that's not sustainable, and second of all, we actually have some ideas out there that are better.
Yeah.
If they could be given the hearing, if they could be given a chance, you know, and to have people look at it, like you said, the conversations are getting easier to talk about. You know, I'm second generation, you know, my dad, second generation, conspiracy theory kind of thing, and grew up with ideas that were really hard to talk about, and now I'm seeing, you know, some of the stuff, the material he was into and whatnot, especially about the Federal Reserve issues and things and fiat currency is now pretty easily accessible, and people are talking about it, and it's interesting to watch the monetary system at the higher level. Basically, it's broken at that level because they don't trust each other because they've been ripping each other off, and they all now know that, right? So with the Forex scandal of where they've been rigging bond, LIBOR, they've been rigging bond, Forex, they've been rigging metals, commodities, and things like that. It's all out now, and the people, and now we have actual arrests of bankers, and in some countries they've been executing bankers who were involved in those scandals. In some countries, banker suicides. You know, it's a little bit like the era of
we got a lot of
banker
suicide here. Yeah.
Well, it's because they, you know, they're now having to face the music of the fact that they have run this thing into the ground and it's not working. And they don't, you know, they've been nose to that system and are culpable. And not been telling people to make money off of it. We were just going over mortgage issues pertaining to our housing situation and where our mortgage came from. And of course, we have the 80% of the mortgages are fraudulently signed. They were signed by the wrong people, and the paperwork for the mortgages were separated to lump them together and make an investment of now what's now toxic assets. And that's why we have this chronic problem with, you know, the part of housing is the fact that it's going to be really hard to restart all these things in the form that they were before. I don't think
Angel,
we go back.
Angel, what do you say? Angel's with us now, guys. Angel's
here. Oh, cool. Hello,
hey,
Angel.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello, Angel.
So we should probably catch you up. For some reason, the discussion was race and social contracts, and we pretty much settled on the fallacy of it all, which was kind of the goal. And then we dove, I mean, we always end up back into the, you know, like kind of the discrepancies of how society is functioning and like the solutions that are coming through. Like right now, Karen was talking about mortgages and land and whatnot. And, just talking about disengaging from it and creating new paths from it. Like race was really more of a catalyst to talk about what we keep talking about, which is the how screwed things are and what we, the ideas that are out there and the things that are happening that are positive, that, you know, the paths that are going. So there you go. Jump in, man.
There's a lot of positive paths, you know, and they're growing every day. They're going to be challenged. You know, that's going to be the case because there's a system that's been built over so many, so many years that has been put together to actually manipulate mind processes and confuse people with legalese and the legal language. And then the administration of, subject matter experts and people relying on subject matter experts to actually either debunk or affirm, what certain corporations and the government have been in bed with and have been implementing. And so, I've seen that personally and have been engaged to disassemble that whole mindset and operational course that they've been taking, which is probably why I'm watched so much. But recently having helicopters over my property and engaging in people that I am connected with regards to previous black operation engagements locally. Informing me that it is NSA that have been flying over my property. So the tactics of intimidation are still intact, which really keeps the people's head in the sand to, the whole idea, all the ideas you're talking about. To segregate groups of people and to pit them against each other, and then to have the whole concept happening within the government, as a show, so to speak, to encourage that type of behavior is negative reinforcement. And it's I think you're right. We do, however, can have the ability as people to nonviolently just walk in and strip them all of their power. But I don't believe at this point that they're going to relinquish power without engaging in some act of violence. So what I believe is that, there are two courses here. If you're going to go nonviolent, then you better go with a lot of people. And if you go with a, go with a lot of people, you have to do what, like, kind of like what Gandhi said. If you you have to be able to walk into the force that they're going to try to utilize on us. And, you know, but that takes unity. And unity has been so far gone within the mentalities of people. And, yeah, we're a bunch of thinkers here on, you know, talking on this radio show. You know, it's not what I see and what I've seen across this country, and I've been across this country, you know, is the fact that, you know, most people aren't truly thinkers yet. And they have so much invested in the lie that they've become part of it, that in order to face that mirror, you know, they're going to have to face what their part in that is. And that's a very difficult sociological parameter, you know, because it's hard to do that on an everyday basis just to face yourself anyway. So now you're talking about an intensity of issue.
Yeah.
You know, dropping down at one time on an individual, and they're, you know, it's not just, oh, what are people in society going to think of me if I change my thinking and my behavior? It's, what is my family now going to think of me? You know? And one has to be ready for the dropping off of people in your life, because that's going to happen. And, you know, that's very, very difficult. You know, that doesn't mean it can't happen, because at any minute, the unseen variable can drop in. And that unseen variable can be a whistleblower, an event that takes place that just pushes people over the edge and destroys the concept of my own little square. Now, oh my God, you know, they've entered my square, and they're entering my neighbor's square, and they're entering everybody's little square. Now what do we do? And now that's when the lines, now there's no box now. You know, so
yeah.
So there must be some sort of, to me, there must be some type of sociological program to be run. And, you know, if my friends of the NSA are listening to me now, which they, you know, I'm on a smartphone, so that could be, I suggest you just step aside. You know, because you have families invested in life as well. And we're not jeopardizing your families. We're talking about a peaceful change that can happen with the unity of all of us. And that includes you, Mr. and Mrs. Agent of the World. You know, it includes you guys. And in fact, we need you guys. Because without your abilities and your powers that you have, you know, bestowed upon yourselves over so many years, because, you know, unlike some other agencies, the NSA, unless they're written into a law, do not have to abide by that law. So they have to be included within a bill before it passes into law in order for them to actually have to abide by it. So right now I'm standing on a piece of property, and I hear everything you guys are saying, okay? Now, if I took our conversation and I went into Valley, Arizona, okay, and I started talking to the man who actually runs that town, okay, all right, and I know him personally. I've shaken his hand. I've spoken to him. We've had discussions. You know, so I walk in and I speak to him, and I drop this on him. There's going to be several things that happen. One, he's going to agree. Two, not only is he going to agree, but at the same time, he's not going to relinquish his powerful role, because he wants to hold on to that. Okay, so, you know, we're dealing with an issue that has so many variances and nuances, you know, and, you know, it doesn't take everyone in the country to change this particular country, you know, it only takes enough people to have the power to do it. So figuring out how many people are ready to do it and organizing that many people, you know, that's really the key. And then sharing that knowledge openly, like, I have no fear. You know, I talk about this stuff everywhere I go. I don't care who the hell's listening. And in fact, if I'm sitting in a restaurant at a bar, and I don't really drink, you know, I'm not a drinker, but I'll go to a bar because I want to have social input within the social programming. So I'll engage there. And what I've noticed, and this is recently as well, what I notice is that the whole place gets quiet. And everyone's listening to the conversation that I'm having with somebody. And all of a sudden, someone will hop into the conversation. And then another person. And then another person. Something that they were scared to speak about. There has to be a catalyst. Because people are looking over their shoulders like, oh, my God, what are people going to think? And, oh, I don't want to start anything, you know. And me, I don't care anymore. I just don't. I'm starting to.
I love that.
I'm going to be the monkey wrench in the negative social entities and what they have done to everybody. And I don't care. If they come after me, I'll deal with them. I'll engage. If they don't come after me, I won't engage. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. You know, and, you know, my whole thing is, okay, I don't like to be violent, you know, but if someone comes onto my property and engages in hostile acts toward my family, game's on. You know, that's off. You know, I will defend my family's lives. I will defend my life. But I don't want to have to get it to that point. You know, so, you know, that's why I'm open about the NSA, because I know they watch and listen to what I have to say personally, because they're very much in show of what they're doing. And, you know, they want to listen, they can. You know, but they're an illegal entity the way they're operating, as far as I'm concerned. You know, which is why you have states fighting back by taking power away from the NSA headquarters in various states, taking away their water source, shutting down their water so they can't cool their computers. You know, people are fighting back, you know, and they're doing it in a peaceful way that they know how to. You know, how do you engage the federal government on a state level, you know, when they've segregated the laws associated to the two? You know, well, we're a state. We could take your water away. You're using our water. What are you going to do, truck it in? You know, I mean, good luck. Then we'll just put tariffs on your water trucks. How about that? Yeah, I mean,
dude, that's the one. Yeah, I was just like what you're saying. One thing that hit me with this is that's it right there. Like, people don't realize that people are fighting. One, two,
yeah.
People don't realize that they can do something. You know, like, okay, so we got you know, this crazy loudmouth hippie out here barking in a bar, and so we're going to watch him. Great. You're sparking people to be a little more open with stuff. But then you've got those people, and all they have to understand, all they have to know, is that the only reason the system has power is because you let it.
That's right.
So stop. And then you go, well, how do you stop? Well, stop. Stop using its money. Start changing your life to not need those things so much, and all of a sudden there's less for it to use. Just
yeah.
Stop, you know? It's as simple as back when people were draft dodging. They got it then. You know how to stop a war from happening. Nobody go, you know?
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah.
But if everybody dodged the draft was worthless. If everybody stopped using the dollar is worthless. Now, here's where I think the universe is working at play in this, is the dollar's collapsing under its own weight. Like, I don't think that things are going to be, it's going to be kind of like a giant change. You know, like, Angel, I don't know if you heard that part, but I got a personal theory that things are just naturally going to follow evolution. And
yeah,
everything's going to change under its own weight at that same course, because the easiest path is to flow with it. There will be some violence in places, and violence isn't always bloodshed. Violence is just anger, using tactics to collapse something. Violence
That's right.
is taking a hammer to dismantle, you know, a pallet without pulling the nails. You know, violence is just using force. Now,
yeah,
the states used violence against the NSA. They were violent. They took away a resource. They did not negotiate a different resource or negotiate a solution to a problem they had between each other. They said, screw you. We're not giving you water. Yeah. And so, like, when people go into this, they don't realize what violence means, or they don't realize what open source means, or they don't realize what power they have, what actually is at the core, at the base of what is going on. And it is, it's just a very simple, simple thing. And it is, you are using their tools. So stop using their tools and make your own. And then all of a sudden, they can't do anything about it. They may end up coming to you and using your tools. And now you're a group and you're happy again. I mean, there are really very few bad people out there. Most people are like Darth Vader. I always go to that, I'm sorry, but there's always an Anakin in every Darth Vader. It's just most people want to be good people. It's easier. Yeah. It's in our nature because it's easier. That's evolution. Evolution adapts to the situation. Well, we are egotistical and we fight evolution. And that's why we end up with the problems we have. But if you just let it go, evolution is just adaptation to scenarios. So we go, this is collapsing. Let's do something else.
I agree with you. I think there is an evolution happening. And you know, even the CIA has come out and admitted to recognition of a consciousness. You know, so when you have that taking place, you know, now we don't want them to end up understanding that shift and trying to control it, mind you, because they think they can, you know, and we don't want them to think that either, because, you know, there's nothing that's going to stop the change. You know, there's going to have to, fiat currency is a phony baloney concept. There's no need for it. There's no value behind it. And, you know, Nixon already took us off of the gold standard way back when. Hell, and the Great Depression, that was a default in the Great Depression. We had to pay what we owed. Our creditors had to get paid. And that's what that gold went to, which is why they started making people gold. They're backing it.
I would like to say something about open source real quick. With the gentleman who's talking about open source everything actually is an ex-CIA employee. And he saw the surveillance state developing, and he said that it becomes that snake chasing its tail. You can't just lock down everyone and watch everyone and expect to have a free-flowing, you know, vibrant economical system. So his concept is by returning to the idea of the commons, by sharing the workload and then sharing the rewards in different aspects of our economy that can be switched over to open source, we start to dismantle the need for surveillance because there's many eyeballs on the problems anyway. It doesn't have to have a Snoopy thing to watch it. It will have everyone watching it. And wanting to make it better.
Well, it's a village taking care of a child, you know? The child's going to be reared the best because you got a gambit of people watching, because you can only one, you know, one entity can only do so much. Yeah, on the money. That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
I never thought of open source in everything, you know? It's just never, you know, I mean, as much as we all, you know, we get together and we talk about these things, and we have a
It's based on the old idea of common law. We used to have the commons.
Yeah.
We had common law. We had sharing of community resources because not everyone could have, like, one kind of, like a for instance, a mill to grind corn. They had a town mill. They didn't have everyone having their own mill, right?
Right.
So we had a reversal of that as we started to have kind of hyper-ownership where everything became more and more privatized, which were kind of took things that used to be commons and made them privatized with the idea that it would be run more efficiently. But it really hasn't served out that way because it became a way, for instance, Zuccotti Park, everyone thinks during Occupy when they went to the park that that's a municipal park. It was not. It was owned by a corporation. So they did have some rights to kind of disperse everyone when people thought it was a public park. So this is
the idea of taking
an idea and reversing it and going back to the common law format.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, is that music?
I hear the cat running across the piano. Yeah.
Yeah, less than a minute.
Oh my God. We keep ending up here. Would you guys want to just dive into this?
I'd like to say something real quick.
Shoot.
In July, in July and August, I'll be working on a prototype with Ben DeVries, a biologist and a permaculturist, to build a terraformer here on EarthQuest property, here on my property in Arizona. The terraformer is going to develop moisture from the air.
Oh, damn.